Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is March 8th, 2022. And we will start, as we always do, with calling the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher, excused. Eklund.
Present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Damoth, present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. A quorum is present. Next order of business is approval of the minutes from yesterday, March 7th, 2022. Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of March 7th of 2022.
All right. Thank you. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right, thank you. The minutes are approved. All right, the first bill we have up today is House File 2768, Representative Morrison. So Representative Morrison would be moving to that House File 2768 be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee bill. And you have an A1. Oh, let's see. Do you have an amendment? No, this one doesn't have an amendment, right? Representative Morrison?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, so the floor is yours. Please tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, thanks for the opportunity to present House File 2768, a bill that will allow pharmacists to administer subcutaneous and intramuscular injections with a prescription and allow them to help patients with external health monitoring devices. I appreciate the co-authorship of Representative Bonner and Vice Chair Hewitt, as well as Representative Davids. And the Senate companion bill is authored by Senator Duckworth and also has bipartisan authorship, includes my physician colleague, Senator Klein. Of the many lessons we've learned from the pandemic, one is how critical our pharmacists are in the delivery of healthcare services. Patients throughout Minnesota have become acutely aware of their important value to their local community. Pharmacists are the health professional a majority of Minnesotans will see each month. Pharmacists are providing critical health services to patients every day, and they should be able to continue to provide these services long after the pandemic is over. Pharmacies have proven to be a great place to rely on trusted, competent care that can be accessed in almost every community across the state. Whether it's administering injectable monoclonal antibody treatments for COVID-19 patients in St. Paul, or monthly mental health injectable medications in Detroit Lakes, or helping with multiple sclerosis patient injections in Worthington, pharmacists can provide these important medication administration services, saving patients time and money and helping them to stay on top of the care they need. These patient scenarios span both rural and urban areas and a number of diagnoses and health conditions. As part of this process, pharmacists meet with patients regularly to provide education and help patients manage all prescribed medications, support interventions that improve the quality of care, engage as part of the healthcare team, and ensure that patients are receiving the expected benefits from their treatment. Once a pharmacist administers a patient's medication, the prescribing provider is informed of the administration. Taking a team care approach is beneficial for the patient, the provider, and the entire health system. A pharmacist is often the health professional to recommend that a patient seek care from a nurse, physician, or other health professional. Pharmacists offer knowledgeable, accessible, and personal care to patients, improving quality of care and patient experiences. Over 30 other states allow pharmacists to help patients with their subcutaneous or intramuscular medication administration including all of our bordering states and Canada, but not in Minnesota. House File 2768 would provide authority for pharmacists to do so and to help patients with their external monitoring devices. This will help ensure patients in Minnesota can access these health services in a community pharmacy. Thank you, Madam Chair. And with that, I would like to turn it over to our testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. So the first on the list here, I have Laura Palombi. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Laura Palombi, and I am a doctor of pharmacy with a master's in public health and master's of arts in theology, and I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy in Duluth. I also have faculty appointments at the U of M Center for Bioethics and School of Public Health. I grew up in a rural community, Ely, Minnesota, and currently live in a rural community, Cloquet, Minnesota. I want to thank you for hearing House File 2768, legislation that allows pharmacists to work with patients, physicians, and other providers to administer prescribed medication through subcutaneous and/or intramuscular injection. I'm here to testify to how pharmacists and pharmacies are currently providing injectable medication administration for patients in Greater Minnesota. I also want to share with you some of the work I and my colleagues have done with rural communities and members of several Native American tribes in Minnesota. In my past work as a community pharmacist, working in rural communities in Carlton and Pine counties, and in my current work with geographically isolated rural communities and tribal nations, including the Boys Fort and Grand Portage Band of Ojibwe, I have seen how the lack of access that underserved communities have to healthcare providers has had an extremely negative impact on their health outcomes. My work and research focuses on substance use and mental health specifically, and I have witnessed how disparities in access have resulted in the loss of Minnesotans' lives. Giving pharmacists broad authority to work with prescribers and their patients makes both practical and economic sense, and most importantly, will save lives. Pharmacists are a highly educated and accessible healthcare provider in the community and are well-versed in team-based care. Allowing pharmacists to expand their practice in the area of injectable medication administration will reduce disparities for a significant subset of the population who are unable to engage in convenient care or avoid traditional medical settings for a variety of reasons that include fear, shame, and stigma. Pharmacists across the state provide education and support to patients as they strive to manage their medications every day. Representative Morrison's bill will allow a pharmacist to provide interventions that include subcutaneous or intramuscular injection as a part of a team-based approach. In my work, I have seen how pharmacists' inability to administer these medications has contributed to health disparities for patients who are already suffering. Allowing pharmacists to administer Vivitrol shots for individuals with substance use disorder, which are injected into the muscle much like a vaccine, is starting to help turn the tide on the opioid overdose epidemic plaguing rural Minnesota by expanding access to a life-saving drug. Pharmacist administration of prescribed medications through subcutaneous and intramuscular can also assist patients who struggle with self-injection by providing initial education and support on medication self-administration, ensuring appropriate follow-up to monitor proper technique, reporting any adverse events, and removing barriers to adherence. My colleagues that practice all of the states around Minnesota and Canada are able to administer these medications. They have the same education and training that I do and can work with our patients' subcutaneous and intramuscular injection needs. In Minnesota, I can't help Minnesota patients with the same healthcare needs. Passing this legislation will make sure that I and other pharmacists can help these patients. Many patients have worked with their providers to have their injections given by their community pharmacist at a location and a time that is convenient to them. Pharmacists are providing critical health services to patients every day and are seeking to continue to provide these services long after the pandemic is over. Patients, providers, and the health of Minnesotans will benefit by enacting these changes to Minnesota law. I urge you to support House File 2768. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and please stay with us in case there are any questions. Next is Michelle Ate. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 2768. My name, Chair Liebling mentioned, is Michelle Ate. I have been a community pharmacist in Minnesota for over 25 years. Most recently, I've personally trained over 1,000 pharmacy technicians on how to properly administer subcutaneous and intramuscular injections to help our patients get COVID immunizations during the pandemic. As you heard from my colleague, Dr. Palumbi, pharmacists in Minnesota are already providing much of these needed medication administrative services to our patients. We're not only trained to provide these services, we're readily accessible. In fact, over 90% of patients live within 5 miles of their community pharmacy. As Representative Morrison mentioned, over 30 states currently allow this, including all the states that border Minnesota. An example that I would like to share with you today on how this legislation would positively impact your patients is helping patients on the fertility journey. Most of us know somebody who has been affected by infertility, and most of these medications that are used to treat infertility are injectables. Just this week, I spoke with a colleague of mine who works with patients undergoing fertility treatment. She said she meets with patients daily who are nervous. They're unsure of doing injections themselves. At times, they're so nervous they may drop their medications and have to repurchase their medications, which can cost hundreds of dollars. A lot of times they're worried, they're crying, they're shaking, they're unable to give an injection themselves. So often they'll have their significant other provide the injection for them. Fertility treatments can range from a one-a-day dose to multiple injections daily. They're very time-sensitive, and it's extremely important to follow the protocol exactly. There's times when a patient who's on a fertility treatment might find out from a blood work or an ultrasound that they need an additional injection within the next hour. So these patients come into our pharmacies to pick up these medications, and they're begging us to help them inject them. We're trained, we're accessible, and we really want to help support our patients in their health journey. And I want to thank you again for your time and your support of House File 2768. I urge you and your colleagues to pass this patient-centric legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Madeline Davies. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for allowing me to testify today. And thank you, Representative Morrison, for offering this bill. My name is Dr. Madeline Davies, and I am a pharmaceutical care leadership resident at the University of Minnesota. I currently practice as a clinical pharmacist at M Health Fairview Smiley's Clinic, and I am speaking on behalf of myself, the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, and the Minnesota Pharmacy Alliance. As a pharmacist, I, along with the majority of my colleagues, have completed a 4-year bachelor's degree and a 4-year doctor of pharmacy. Many pharmacists will choose to complete an additional year or two of postgraduate training in a residency or fellowship, as I am doing currently. Pharmacists become licensed through completion of a national licensing exam, and we may choose to undergo board certification later in our career. Pharmacists are the most accessible healthcare practitioners, as we've been hearing today, and patients frequently see their local pharmacist more frequently than their primary care provider. This bill seeks to expand pharmacists' authority to administer medications into the muscle and under the skin. We are currently administering vaccines using these methods, and we educate patients on these administration techniques when they pick up medications at the pharmacy. However, as you've heard, some patients are very hesitant to self-administer injectable medications, and some medications require a bit of monitoring after administration. Pharmacists are trained in these actions during our education. Pharmacists who graduated before PharmD was available have the option to become trained to administer these injections, and many of these pharmacists do choose to undergo this training because many patients have become accustomed to receiving their immunizations at the local pharmacy. Regardless of level of training, all of us understand the importance of using medications safely and monitoring patients after injection. There are many injectable medications available that patients are currently picking up at the pharmacy and bringing to their provider's clinic for administration. Just to name a couple of examples, Prolia is an injectable shot given once every 6 months for osteoporosis or weakening of the bones. Depo-Provera is a shot given every 3 months to prevent pregnancy or help with endometriosis. We can decrease the time that patients are currently spending on this process by including medication administration as part of the practice of pharmacy. In addition, this bill touches on placement of external monitoring devices, such as a continuous glucose monitoring device. I am currently doing this, and many of my colleagues are currently doing this at our clinics, and we would just like it to be recognized as part of the practice of pharmacy. In summary, pharmacists are the medication experts on the healthcare team. We ask that you please support HF2768 to increase patient access and help patients feel more comfortable administering their life-saving, life-improving medications. Thank you for your time, and I will be happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you for your testimony. And then finally, we have Dr. Cody Weiberg. Dr. Weiberg?
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I actually don't have any prepared testimony. I'm here mostly to answer any questions there might be about either of the two pharmacy-related bills. The Board of Pharmacy will be considering this legislation and other legislation affecting pharmacists and pharmacies at its meeting next week. However, based on past discussion of bills like this, I'm fairly confident that the Board of Pharmacy members themselves would support this legislation. And I can certainly answer any questions that anyone might have about the board's possible perspective here.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Weiberg. And we're going to go to member discussion, and Representative Ackland is first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for Michelle Atag. And you, Michelle, you said something as you were talking. You mentioned these injections being given by pharmacy techs. And as I read the bill, I'm wondering, did you mean pharmacy techs or do you mean pharmacist?
Ms. Atag.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you, Representative Ackland, and thank you for asking that question, that clarifying question. I am both an American Pharmacy Association immunization trainer for pharmacists and technicians, and that training involves training technique for doing intramuscular and subcutaneous injections. So although I've trained both and trained over 1,000 technicians to provide COVID immunizations, this bill is not asking for us to allow them to provide these medications. I was just using it as an example so that you know we are trained and would love to be able to provide these services to our patients.
Thank you.
Good catch, Representative Ackland.
Yes, thank you, Representative Ackland.
Good catch.
And Chair.
Anything further, Representative Ackland? No.
That's all, thank you.
Okay, Representative Bonner.
Thank you so much. Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing this forward. As Representative Morrison alluded to in full disclosure, I am a co-author on this bill. And the reason I am, I'm going to be very upfront, is the need is just so incredible to be able to have these services at your local pharmacy, particularly if you're new to giving injections or putting in a device. My sister is a type 1 diabetic. And that can be really intimidating, particularly in the beginning. And so the ability to do this at your local pharmacy is such an incredible service to the community. And I'm really thankful that we can have this conversation about making that accessible to folks where they are. As you know, they are so much closer than the local clinic. It's very easy to access your pharmacist, and pharmacists have the training to do it. So that alone, I think, gives such a tremendous weight to this bill. And so I'm grateful that Representative Morrison has brought it forward, and I will be supporting it today for sure. And I certainly hope to encourage my colleagues to do so as well.
All right, thank you, Representative Bonner. I also have a couple questions. Oh, I'm gonna let Representative Bierman go first though. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just had a question regarding the actual service of doing the injections. Are the pharmacies covered for that activity with an additional fee, or how does that transaction work?
Oh, let's see. I don't know who would be best to answer that question. Let's see. I don't know if, do any of our testifiers care to try to answer that? How would this be reimbursed? Dr. Weiberg, I don't know if you, there's Ms. Atag, maybe you could take a stab at it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I was going to jump in and take a stab, but I don't know that I have a good answer. Currently, I believe the intent of the language is to be able to provide these services to our patients. We are doing this with monoclonal antibodies currently, so there are some payment models available out there. Sometimes most things back in the pharmacy are ran through the pharmacy claims department, but some of these may need to be ran through the medical side. I don't claim to be an expert on it, so I apologize. Representative Hewitt, I'd be happy to follow up on that for you, but I don't know that the bill covers that, but I don't want to misspeak. Sarah from MPHA may be on as well and may be able to provide some insight.
Okay. We can get an answer, Madam Chair, later too. That's fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. I'm not.
Oh, yeah, right. That's Representative Bierman, but that's okay.
Oh, Bierman. That's okay. Right. I see Representative. Right. He has his hand.
It's okay.
All right.
Quite thank right. you, Representative Bierman. We'll work on that. I think
Madam
it's
Chair,
probably
just one last thing. I just do want to say that there were a number of references to being like the states around us, and I don't always think it's best to be like the states around us, but in this case, I do. So thank you, Representative Morrison, for the bill. I do like the bill. Thanks.
All right, good point, Representative Bierman. Okay, Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, and I'm sorry if I missed this, but what is it, just real quickly, a pharmacy tech, what training do they have before they come to you and are ready to go?
And Representative Hewitt, I don't think the bill deals with the pharmacy tech doing this.
I missed out on that then. I can ask that later. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, we had a little confusion about that earlier on, but no, this does not give the right to pharmacy techs to give these injections. And Representative Bonner, I'm gonna let you, and then I also have a question, and then we're gonna go forward. Representative Bonner.
I actually have an answer to your question. Sometimes these services are not covered or reimbursable. And as a matter of fact, I actually have a bill for that, which we will hopefully be able to hear in this committee at another time.
Okay, thank you, Representative Bonner. So I have a couple of questions, and one of them is for Dr. Weiberg from the Board of Pharmacy, and that is just to be clear about how pharmacists would be monitored for providing this. I mean, my understanding is that this is, you know, these are not super high skill things to do, and that with proper training, you know, competent people can learn to give these injections. But, you know, if there should be, you know, some kind of incompetence, or, you know, is this the sort of thing that the board will be kind of adding to its oversight of pharmacists then, if this is added to the definition?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. You know, a bill somewhat similar to this was introduced 2 or 3 years ago. And one of the questions I had was, well, can pharmacists really do this? And the expectation that we have for pharmacists, even now, for the things that are included in the practice of pharmacy now, are that they are properly trained before they take on a particular duty. So as an example, compounding is something that pharmacists have been doing for centuries, but these days, the compounding of sterile products that have to be injected, there are very strict standards that have to be followed, including training standards. So even though the law says pharmacists can compound, if we had a pharmacist that compounded a product that didn't have that training and a patient got hurt, we could certainly take disciplinary action. So if this law were to pass, we would simply, we would put out our annual piece about laws that affect the practice of pharmacy that were passed, and we would remind pharmacists that before that they engaged in these new activities, the board would expect them to have proper training.
Great. Thank you for that, Dr. Weiberg. It kind of makes me think about, right, under medical practice, a physician is licensed, and in theory, they're licensed to perform all the branches of medicine, right? But if they go and start performing brain surgery when they're not qualified to do that, that's problematic, right? Even though they are licensed technically, it sounds very similar to that.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And Dr. Morrison, Dr. Representative Morrison is kind of nodding, so that's good. And then the other question I have, perhaps for one of the testifiers, similar question, has to do with professional liability insurance. This would, I assume, be, you know, I expect it would be a very rare that there would be any kind of problem doing this, but if there were to be, I assume that it would be under the pharmacist's general professional liability insurance that it would be covered. Ms. Ate, is that one for you?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, yes, most of the employers that we work for do have liability insurance, and many of us carry our own as well. I would just like to, again, thank everyone and let you know that we are currently providing almost all of these services under the PREP Act. So we'd like to continue to take care of these patients after our pandemic is over. So it's not something new for us. It's something that we want to continue to be able to provide for our patients.
All right. Well, thank you for that clarification. And I just think one of the things that really appeals to me about the bill is the piece about the monitors and helping patients, because I have personal experience right now with a family member that I have to help place their monitor. And it's not rocket science, but it's difficult to do yourself sometimes. So, you know, so anyway, appreciate all of the testifiers. And Representative Morrison, any final word before we lay the bill over?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, and very grateful to our testifiers both for being here today to testify and the important work that they do in our communities. This is one of the many lessons from COVID. Is there are ways in which we learn to provide better care to people, and this is one of them. So again, gratitude to the pharmacists in Minnesota, and thanks for the consideration.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Morrison, and testifiers. So House File 2768 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And next up, we have Representative Hollins with House File 3854. And she's not on the committee, so the chair will move that House File 3854 be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee bill. And there is an A1 author's amendment, which I will move on behalf of Representative Hollins. And Representative Hollins, do we need to, should we just adopt that to get the bill in the shape in which you'd like to present it? Yeah, okay.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you.
All right, so there's an A1 author's amendment. I have moved that. Any discussion? All in favor of adoption of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Hollins, welcome, and please go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. My internet connection is being a little unstable, so I'm going to try to be as brief as possible. I keep going in and out. I appreciate you hearing this bill. 9,000 Minnesotans live with HIV and or AIDS, with 300 new cases diagnosed every year. We have some really ambitious goals for the state of Minnesota to have new HIV diagnoses be rare, and that all people living with HIV or at high risk of infection have access to high quality healthcare by 2025. To meet this goal, we really have to expand our pre-exposure and post-exposure prophylaxis that is available. And this bill seeks to do just that. What this bill would do is authorize a pharmacist to prescribe, dispense, and administer drugs for preventing HIV, as well as authorize ordering, conducting, and interpreting laboratory tests necessary for the therapies that use drugs for preventing HIV. This is especially important because timely access to these prophylaxis is incredibly important. There is 72 hours in which when you can be exposed, in which you need treatment by that time. And pharmacists are trained and will operate under protocol from the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. So they are, you know, very well trained in how to do this. And what's really nice about this is that most Minnesotans live within 5 miles of a pharmacy and see their pharmacist much more often than they see a doctor. This is especially true for groups of people who might be at high risk for contracting HIV, who don't have a regular physician for whatever reason that might be. And so making it easy for them to get access to these PEP and PrEP medications is especially important. Finally, I'll just note that there are many other states that have taken this step, including Virginia, Idaho, California, New York, Nevada, Oregon, et cetera. This isn't something new. This is just new for us in Minnesota. And I know I have a number of very qualified testifiers, so I will turn it over to them.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hollins. So we have Matt Toburin. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Toburin, he, him, Executive Director of the Alliance Project, a community center for people living with and at risk for HIV/AIDS. A few years ago, this committee and the legislature unanimously passed a nation-leading bill to create a statewide plan to end AIDS. This important legislation brought together state agencies, doctors, community organizations, and people living with HIV to develop a comprehensive plan to reduce and end HIV infections in Minnesota. The bill before you today is one of the recommended policy changes that has come from this effort. PrEP is a critical new tool in our toolbox to prevent HIV transmission. Unfortunately, many Minnesotans at highest risk for HIV are not accessing this biomedical intervention. 50% of new infections occur in communities of color, yet these communities are accessing PrEP in much lower numbers than white Minnesotans. Barriers to access include cost, awareness, lack of routine medical care, or mistrust of the medical system. Until we can increase uptake of PrEP in these communities, we're not going to be successful in bringing about an end to the epidemic. This bill helps remove barriers so that those at greatest risk will have easier access. We have the knowledge and the tools to end HIV in Minnesota. This bill, if passed, is one big step in that direction. Thank you for your support for House File 3854.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. James Talbot, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Speaker and members of the committee. I'm so grateful to be here today. I actually am here to just share my story. A few years ago, more than a few years ago, actually, I was exposed to HIV. Like Representative Hollins had shared, I had 72 hours to get the life-saving medicine known as PEP to ensure that I did not contract HIV. I was unfortunately on that a three-day holiday weekend, so I was trying to contact my doctor to get that life-saving drug into my system. Fortunately, I was able to get that, and I was HIV, and I am HIV negative. I do think it's important, though, you know, to know that only about 10% of the total, you know, 1.2 million people nationwide have access to, you know, PEP and PrEP medication. And I think we could really benefit from this bill passing. I think this is really the last step to really ending HIV in Minnesota. So thank you for letting me be here today. And hopefully expanding PEP and PrEP access.
All right, thank you, Mr. Talbot. Appreciate your being here today. And then we have Jamie Swanson.
Hi, welcome. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for your time today. I'm an HIV specialty pharmacist at Walgreens Uptown, where we currently serve over 1,200 patients on medications to either treat HIV or prevent HIV. Frequently, I've had patients call our pharmacy wondering whether PrEP would be a good option for them, while pointing out barrier concerns that they have, such as tolerability, affordability, and accessibility. PrEP has been available for 10 years now. In the first 3 years of being available, only 3% of patients that qualified for it were taking the medication. We've significantly reduced one of the biggest barriers since its introduction, which was affordability. But even with these measures, less than 1 in 5 patients that are at risk of acquiring HIV were prescribed it in 2020. Many patients that I've consulted with when they first get prescribed PrEP state that they've been thinking about pursuing this as an option for months, sometimes even years. Think of all the times during that period they had been in a potential situation of acquiring HIV. If we genuinely want to meet the goal of reducing new HIV infections by 2025, we need to make a more proactive approach to immediately connecting these patients to the safe and effective HIV reduction measures that have been available. This bill will put pharmacists in a position to quickly act on getting preventative medications in patients' hands quicker. Last week, I met with an individual who had a potential exposure to HIV. During the consult session, he disclosed that he had repeated exposures to HIV in the past. We then had a really great discussion on the appropriateness of PrEP and taking it on a more regular basis, how to be more proactive with reducing his risk of acquiring HIV, and linking him to a provider for continued care. He was thankful that a pharmacist would feel so comfortable discussing this with him, and as a result, he felt more confident about pursuing this vital preventative measure. Allowing pharmacists to prescribe PrEP and PEP would provide another patient access point to receive the pre- and post-exposure medications that they need. I urge you to please push this forward and allow pharmacists to practice at the top of our education. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Swanson. And before I go to Representative Quam with a question, I just want to ask you, could you describe a little bit there's a process involved, I understand, with some testing that needs to be done, and that's part of this as well. And could you just give us a brief explanation of how that works or how it would work in the pharmacy?
Yeah, definitely, Madam Chair. Thank you for that question. So patient safety has always been at the forefront of pharmacy care. And so PrEP does come with making sure that it's appropriate. So some of the tests per CDC guidelines are making sure that they have a negative HIV test, also making sure that they have hepatitis B, either vaccination or have done the testing for that. And so that would be something where we would have to make sure that those labs are done prior to initiation of PrEP. NPEP is a little bit more time sensitive. So that's the case of where it's a post-exposure. And in that case, we only have a 72-hour turnaround time for them to get started for it to be effective. So that gets a little bit more tricky in terms of the labs. And so that's why we see a lot of that getting missed in urgent care centers and emergency visits, just because of the knowledge that's needed for prescribing these. And so our program would make sure that patients and pharmacists would be adequately trained on making sure that these steps are met prior to dispensing and prescribing.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Okay, we have three member questions. First, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to find out what training and certification is required to be a HIV specialty pharmacist.
All right, Ms. Johnson.
Yes, thank you for that question. Members of the committee, what is required to be an HIV specialty pharmacy is we have to not only obviously graduate from a college of pharmacy, accredited college of pharmacy, but we do also undergo 42 and a half hours of CEs. We have to do that every 2 years to keep up to date on not just HIV positive care, but also preventative measures, since that is such a big initiative right now. And then we do that certificate. We do have to pass a pretty intense exam to test our knowledge. And then we do that every 2 years.
All right, thank you. Representative Quam, follow up?
Yes, it'd be interesting. And maybe the committee could receive some of this information about the process in Minnesota versus other states for specialty pharmacists, because I'm sure there are other areas so we can become more familiar with it. And my understanding is that there would be able to order labs. Is this part of the additional scope that be in this bill?
Yeah, Representative Quam, I think Ms. Swanson was just discussing that in response to my question. So we'll hold on that. Let's go to the other questions and then see if we need to follow up more with that, depending on what other members are asking. So let's see, next is Representative Ackland.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. A little bit more about the lab testing, I'm curious. So do you have a designated lab that you will send the blood work out, and how does it get there? You know, that whole chain of making sure things are treated properly. So I'm assuming it has to go out to a lab somewhere. And then how long does it take from the time it gets to that lab until you get the result? Does the patient wait in the pharmacy until you get the lab results, or do they leave and come back, he or she? I'm just curious about that, because part of the hope here is that the patient can just come in and get their medicine. But when I see this lab process, it seems to me that that's a little bit of a glitch in the plan, I might say.
Okay, so we've got two different kinds of medication here too, so we have to be sure to distinguish between them. We have the preventative and then we have the treatment. So Ms. Watson, can you address the testing a little bit more? Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So that is a completely valid question. Patient safety is something that is very important to pharmacists and making sure that it is safe and effective. Now, a lot of the labs can be done point of care as well. So they do have rapid HIV tests that we are able to help administer. Now, there would be a requirement for following up with a primary care provider for kidney levels, and that is typically done every 6 months. And so that point would be a little bit, would need a little bit more time. I don't know, Michelle, if you're able to address that a little bit more.
Or I see also that, Ms. Ate, and you need to introduce yourself again for the record and go ahead and answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I actually was going to thank you. I was going to defer to Dr. Weiberg. I believe, Dr. Weiberg, you joined to share the board protocol on what we would be following on this. If you would like to share that, please, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Okay, Dr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. I can't share the actual protocol because we haven't developed it yet until the law passes, but we will be looking at what the other states are doing, just as we did when we developed protocols for pharmacists prescribing oral contraceptives and other meds. Dr. Swanson, I believe, mentioned that some of the tests that are done are actually, patients can actually buy some of these tests and bring them home and do them themselves. And so certainly a pharmacist can be able to help them do that in the pharmacy setting or the clinic setting where the pharmacist would be performing the service. Those tests are ready, I believe, in 20 minutes, I believe. Relatively quickly. In terms of some follow-up tests for PrEP, in particular, I think the protocol that we would develop would have a requirement for the pharmacist to refer the individual for those follow-up tests and to have the results of those tests before continuing to prescribe and dispense the medications.
Follow-up, Representative Ackland?
Just a quick question. Are these medications, I think I heard they were quite expensive. I don't know if they all are, some are. Are they not kept in the clinics? Is that, you know, physicians a lot of times will keep a stock of B12 or this or that. Do they keep a stock of this in the clinic typically? Yes or no?
And you're talking about the physician clinic, not the pharmacy.
The physician clinic, right.
Dr. Swanson, do you have an answer for that? I don't know if that's not really your bailiwick, but.
Yeah, members of the committee, thank you for that. So they are currently not stocked in clinic. And so we've seen it vary from ERs having maybe a dose in stock for them to get it immediately. But most oftentimes when a patient leaves, they do not have any of the medication until they get to the pharmacy.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Backer.
Yeah, two questions. In regards, when you draw for the labs. I'm assuming you're drawing the blood like you would do before you do a donate blood, or is it a smaller amount like when you test for diabetes? That's my first question. And second question is, how, you know, is this then, you know, the payment of this? Do you submit this, I'm assuming through Medicaid, Medicare, PrimeWest, like a normal insurance, like going to a hospital because it's a lab test type of scenario? Is the pharmacy?
Okay. We got you, Representative Backer. So even though your connection's a little weak, but so
thank
Dr.
you.
Swanson, if you could tell us about the testing, and then I don't know if you know about the billing, the cost piece. I don't know. I might go to Representative Hollins for that if she knows, but Dr. Swanson.
Yes, thanks, members of the committee. So in terms of billing and reimbursement, currently that would be likely billed under a medical service where we are not able to submit to most plans for that service, which just greater shows that we're just really passionate to making sure that the service is provided. And then the other piece for lab testing, some of them do require or like oral swabs. Some of them with point of care, you do not have to draw blood. Anything more than like a finger prick, like what you would do when you're testing like blood sugars, for instance. And the more intense like follow-up labs, like the kidney checks, liver, that would all be referred out likely to a healthcare provider or a health system that would be able to do that. And I think that, you know, this seems like we're really addressing like long-term prescribing, which would be, you know, I think we would be able to develop a great protocol. But the true focus that I have on this is that it would be a bridge of therapy, right? Like when I get a patient that calls in that's really interested in PrEP and has questions, to be able to provide that service, maybe get 30 days of medication to the patient, to be able then to refer him or her to a different provider for long-term follow-up as well. So it's not necessarily that we would take, you know, control of it for all patients for the entire length of therapy. The big hesitation that we see with patients is that first step of getting on medication. So this would really help bridge that connection between pharmacy and provider as well.
Okay, great. It sounds like this would probably be addressed in the protocol that would be developed by the Board of Pharmacy. And Dr. Weiberg is shaking his head yes, that's true. And so did anyone else want to address the question about billing? I don't know if anyone here on the call is really prepared to do that. I don't know if Dr. Weiberg, go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would just point out that I believe the bill has some requirements that health plans do pay for this. How that actually would be done and operationalized, I'm not quite sure if that's a medical claim or a pharmacy claim, but yeah.
Okay, thank you. Representative Quam.
Yes, that since a lot of people have different providers for pharmacy and medical, and then I was wondering if there are any, we've run into problems where the federal regulations affect who and where certain things can be billed. And I was hoping that since this will be laid over, that the author or someone could give us a more detailed look at the complexities there, because I would hate to have something start out and then run afoul of some regulation or a snafu down the line. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Quam. And Representative Hollins, I think you wanted to respond, but also I'm going to give you the final word. So please go ahead and then we'll lay the bill over.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Quam. I just wanted to add that is what the amendment was doing, is making sure that That was an amendment that was brought to our attention by DHS to make sure that the substantive part of the bill also applies to MA and Minnesota Care and medical assistance fee for service to make sure that it all falls in line so that it can be billed back the way it needs to be. With regard to the federal side of things, I'm not as familiar, but I can certainly learn more and get back to you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hollins. And any final words just on the bill before we, in general, before we lay it over?
Since my internet's going in and out, sorry. Okay. Just thank you. And I appreciate your time on this and I appreciate my testifiers.
All right. Well, thank you very much to the testifiers. Thank you for bringing the bill, Representative Hollins. And so House Ball 3854, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the committee bill. Thank you. Okay, we will move now to House File 3631, Representative Morrison, and she is moving that House File 3631 be laid over for possible inclusion, and she has an author's amendment that she would like us to adopt. So she's moving the A1, I assume, to get the bill in the form in which she would like to discuss it.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Morrison.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
All right. Any discussion to the A1? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Morrison, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, House File 3631 is a bill that makes changes to Chapter 147 in the Medical Practice Act. It amends sections of the Medical Practice Act to update references to osteopathic physician organizations and examinations. It clarifies examination attempts and authorizes acceptance of the Comprehensive Osteopathic Medical Variable Purpose Examination, or COMVEX. COMVEX is an equivalent examination to the Special Purpose Examination, or SPECS, which is currently authorized in statute. A general skills examination is required when an applicant has not completed a national licensing examination within the 10 years prior to application and is not specialty board certified. It also makes changes to Chapter 147B, removing the requirement for a notarized copy and replacing it with the requirement for evidence of satisfactory to the board of current NCCAOM certification. And finally, it repeats section of Minnesota rules related to professional corporations, as those rules were made obsolete by passage of the Professional Firms Act in Chapter 319B of Minnesota statutes. And I do believe I have Ruth Martinez from the Board of Medical Practice here, and I believe she is going to testify, or maybe she's here to answer questions.
Okay, thank you, Representative Morrison. Ms. Martinez, did you want to give some testimony?
Welcome. Madam Chair and Representative Morrison, thank you. We appreciate the invitation to testify. At this point, I will say that although the board had some additional language, we have had conversation with Representative Morrison about the amendment, and I'm here to answer any additional questions. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Are there questions from members? I think we used up all our questions on the previous bill, so I'm not seeing any. So, Representative Morrison, final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the Board of Medical Practice collaboration. Thank you for consideration.
All right, thank you. So, House File 3631, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. And then finally, we have House File 3989, Representative Bonner. And so her motion is that House File 3989 be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee bill. And she has the A2 amendment. And Representative Bonner, did you want to move that? And did you want to describe it or just move it and then adopt it and then discuss it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A2 amendment first and then go ahead and describe the bill as amended.
All right. So the A2 is before us. Any discussion to the A2? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And the A2 is adopted. I think everybody's getting tired here in the late afternoon. Either that or the internet is just having problems. So Representative Bonner, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, back in 2020, Chair Schultz carried a bill, co-authored by many on this committee, as a matter of fact, that updated the Practice Act for Physician Assistants. Specifically, that law modified how PAs were supervised. These changes were a great success, providing over 10 million patient encounters by PAs since its passage. We are grateful for the hard work of the PAs and the exceptional work that they do. While the original bill did modify the scope of practice, the one before you does not alter or change the scope of practice, how they are supervised, or how they are educated. Rather, the bill before you today is largely a technical bill in nature that completes the unfinished business of cleaning up language for consistency with the original bill. It is also similar in nature, to the APRN cleanup bill from a few years ago. Specifically, what the bill does: the bill updates 169 cross-references that required updating within the statute that regulate the practice of medicine and the practice of pharmacy. It adds the words physician assistant or and physician assistant throughout. In addition, the amendment updates 4 references to APRN, changing the language from certified nurse practitioner the more modern and preferred term of advanced practice registered nurse that were not caught in the original bill. Lastly, it updates 2 PA references and clarifies 1 caught by NAMI for greater accuracy and clarity to make sure the language is crisp. The bill is supported by the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants and the APRN Coalition. There are letters of support in your packet. It has been reviewed by MMA, the Board of Medicine, the Board of Pharmacy, and NAMI, and has no opposition. And with that, Madam Chair, I do not have any testifiers for the bill. However, I do have folks here from the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants. We also have folks from the APRN Coalition, as well as a number of folks, as you mentioned earlier, from the Board of Pharmacy and the Board of Medical Practice to answer any potential questions.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. So I know that every member of this committee has read every page of this bill. It's, 130 pages or something?
Only.
Okay. And I know that you're all pouring through it with your red pencil. So I don't see any questions. Are there questions from members about one of the many, many lines you read in the bill? Okay. I do have a question for, I see that we have Becky Ness here from the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants. Hello, welcome. And so my question, because this is, as Representative Bonner said, largely a technical bill, I just would like, because this is the kind of bill where, I know that your association has gone through this and very carefully and worked this out, but is it largely technical or is it entirely technical in your view? Does it change anything that physician assistants are actually able to do now after the previous change in the law? If you would introduce yourself for the record, Ms. Nassen, please, if you can.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for this opportunity. My name is Becky Ness. I've been a practicing PA in Minnesota for the last 21 years. I work with Mayo Clinic Health System in Mankato currently. And to answer your question specifically, this bill is a technical amendment. There is no change in scope of practice. There is no change in supervision. There is no extension to what PAs can do. This cleans up many, many, many other areas in legislation to reflect the changes that were passed with the 2020 PA Modernization Act.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Any questions from members based on that or anything else? I'm not seeing any. All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Ness. And with that, Representative Bonner, do you have any final word on the bill?
Just to say thank you for the hard work of the physician assistants, as well as the APRNs, for bringing forward the corrections. And certainly, I hope to have your support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. So with that, House File 3989, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the committee bill. And we have reached the end of our agenda. I am amazed. This is the first time this has happened to us all year, I think. So we'll have to schedule more things than we can get to, just to make sure that we don't have to give you back any of your lifetime here. But we are giving you all half an hour back today, and use it well, take a nap or something, because we're going to be even busier than we have been. So tomorrow we are hearing a bill from Representative Stevenson on the Minnesota Premium Security Plan, and we're hearing from Representative Bierman a really interesting bill, interesting discussion on opioids and intractable pain. So with that, I look forward to seeing everyone tomorrow, and we stand adjourned.